To the last Sunday in January. As you know, in January, we have been looking at the umbrella theme of the path of spiritual evolution on our Sunday presentations. This morning, we have a panel presentation entitled The Higher Ethic of Spiritual Evolution. And this is a weighty subject, but an uplifting subject, if you will, all in one. We know that there's lots of popularized belief systems and that ideas rule the world. And so on our January Sunday sessions, the series has outlined the oneness, the universality of the teaching of spiritual evolution, the various applications possible for spiritual evolution. And this morning we approach the concept of oneness yet again. But now we have all of the experience of the month behind us. Ethics. Big subject. Applied knowledge of ethics, customs, mores, morals, norms, traditions, conformities of all kinds. We look around at the modern world and we see the call, the innate call for ethics. We also see the great range of possibilities in understanding and applying that concept. Each individual seeker of truth embodies, energizes, and experiences the pairs of opposites, the relativity of motive. Each individual answers to the call for ethical right living, may exhibit a changing notion of how to live rightly, and each individual may be tempered by the collective understanding of the environment in which they live. We can think of many examples of the struggle that each individual faces to conform to the needs of physical life and yet to apply ethics. Examples like simply living to save the environment while being as warm as we can be on a winter day. The dilemma, the polar opposites that are apparent in the vegan, non-vegan eating styles. The list could go on and on and on. Each individual seeks to understand ethics within the context of their environment, but answering that call, that what if, that comes from within. We also know that what is deemed to be good in one time period can come to be judged as bad in another. The concept of ethics is limited by the validity of the premise used for logical thinking and for blind faith. Looking at Christianity alone for the range of ethics based upon the premise of a unique creation for a sempiternity, vicarious atonement, the fight between the way of works for good versus the way of belief alone, an individual salvation that might even be preordained at birth or manifested in the health and wealth of the now, of the power of or prestige of one over others in life. We see tremendous change and variations and nuances in ethics. So this morning, let us open our mind and heart to theosophical premise of one higher ethic of spiritual evolution, universally available to one and to all. In, above, and beyond the changing understandings of the duality of good and evil, the myriad manifestations of creeds and cultures, stands one source, one perfectibility, one call to seek the one higher ethic. Robert Crosby was quoted in a series of articles of the 10th volume of the Theosophical Movement, and that 10th volume is really interesting. There's a series of articles explaining or expanding the study of the voice of the silence. Crosby was quoted as saying, "All down the ages, there is a record of good motive, but power and zeal misused for want of knowledge." Theosophy is that path of spirit gaining experience, gaining knowledge, and then transmuting that knowledge to wisdom, one ethic. Theosophy is divine wisdom. The premise of the eternal verities of the true nature of self, universal brotherhood, the golden rule, the Kuan Yin pledge, these are a gold standard for the higher ethic of spiritual evolution. In Isis Unveiled, you can find in volume 2 on page 635 these words of HPB. "The world needs no sectarian church, whether of Buddha, Jesus, Muhammad, Swedenborg, Calvin, or any other. There being but one truth, man requires but one church, the temple of God within us, walled in by matter but penetrable by anyone who can find the way. The pure in heart see God." So many humans creating so many gods and so many degrees of ethics, including even the notion of negative goodness espoused by materialists, agnostics, atheists alike. There can be seen a spectrum of degrees of selfishness, self-centeredness, selflessness, relative to what the individual thinks, relative to what might or could be. Intrinsic to each and all, regardless of life's conditions and regardless of these varied manifestations that we see, is an impressive spirit in the human nature, that perfectibility is a fact in nature, that through the cause and effect process, we can move along in perfectibility, and that through self-fulfilled, self-devised methods, we can evolve a spiritual reality for all, not for just oneself. Among truth seekers, using the premises of universal oneness, karma and reincarnation, and evolution, can be seen dual paths of a certain kind to the higher ethic. Some ultimately seek the individual salvation in the desire for moksha, nirvana, devachanic heavenly states, while others ultimately seek to renounce this individual salvation for what they see as a greater good of continuing to serve in the nirmanakaya state. This morning, you will hear terms like doctrine of the eye, doctrine of the heart, path of liberation, path of renunciation. And you can explore these notions on the pages of texts like the Voice of the Silence and the Bhagavad Gita. As you do so, be cognizant that this pondering, whichever way you think of this higher ethic of spiritual evolution, is actually one path based upon higher ethics of spirit over matter, of doing no harm, of delivering service without seeking individual reward. So let's turn first to the doctrine of the eye, that of the crowd, the open path, the path of liberation, a truly lofty ethic. And again, you can see this on the pages of the Voice and the Gita. This practice is involved in endeavoring to center in spirit 24/7 so as to benefit mankind. And it can be focused. We can see folks doing this in the study of scripture. The offer offering of sacrificing the dearer way of life to the better way of life, to attuning, making every endeavor to attune one's heart to the pain of humanity so as to take action to relieve the suffering on this plane of existence. In the sincere practice of using spiritual fire to burn out the dross of personal flaws, we can see virtues being attempted and valued. We see the effort to renounce the personal self and to move into the light and life of the higher self. We see duties and works of charities being fulfilled within the conditions offered by the law of karma, the mundane. We see the lure, however, of reaching the bliss immediate. The immediate motive for world peace and brotherhood here on this plane, followed by rest on the next plane. This is an application of the ideas of periods of activity and inaction, periodicity, the world's eternal ways. The open path is apparent, and Krishna speaks of it in the second chapter of the Gita. A man is said to be confirmed in spiritual knowledge when he forsaketh every desire which entered into his heart, and of himself is happy and content in the self. His mind is undisturbed in adversity. He is happy and contented in prosperity, and he is a stranger to anxiety, fear, and anger. The ethic of right action and performance of duty is thus coupled in the practice of Raja Yoga with detachment. In the 10th chapter of the Gita, Krishna invites the proper stance of being for each seeker of truth, for all mindful moments of meditation, whether it's 24/7 or a fixed seated session. Krishna says, I am the ego. I am the ego which is seated in the hearts of all beings. I am the beginning, the middle, and the end of all existing things. I establish this whole universe with a single portion of myself and remain separate. In chapter 15, Krishna goes further. There are two kinds of beings in the world, the one divisible and the other indivisible. The divisible is all things and creatures. The indivisible is called Tuthasva, or he who standeth on high, unaffected. And so we see how all those seeking to create a sinless life, one above reproach and based on an eternal higher ethic, far higher than mundane standards, can ultimately find duality on the one path. The I doctrine of the open path does embody the higher ethic. But as we read on page 46 in the 5 years of Theosophy, Raja Yoga has to do with the inner man whose sphere lies in the world of thought, to have the highest ideal placed before oneself and to strive incessantly to rise up to it is the only true concentration. It deals with the inner world of the noumena. Purity of heart can be behind what we sense with eyes, our lower minds, even when we are perplexed by what we see and know to be true. So let's turn now to the second presentation to explore the higher ethic in yet another light on the path.
We'll begin this presentation with a recapitulation of just a few of the points mentioned by the previous panelists. And that is the notion between the difference between ethics and morality. So ethics is a set of moral principles concerning what is good for human beings and what is good for humanity. And as we know, there's all sorts of ethical systems, and we can have an environmental ethic, we can have a medical ethic, we can have educational ethics, we can have research ethics, and we can have ethics in the various religious systems. But the idea is a set of moral principles. So when we say moral, what we're referring here is to the judgment of what is good and right as a basis for thought and action, as distinguished between what is immoral or bad or wrong. And of course, there are many aspects of life which are amoral. In other words, an action can be taken irrespective of the good or right or bad or wrongness of the action. So morality is based on what is good and right. And so when we think about it, a human being innately is a moral, amoral being, and cannot escape from that responsibility or duty, because they are inherently endowed with the capacity for free will and reason. And it's the presence of those capacities which forces us, whether we like it or not, to figure out and to make choices what is right or wrong or good or bad for us to do. And the interesting thing is, as was brought out, is human beings do not necessarily share any definite, absolute ideal of what is moral, good, and right. Nevertheless, their notions of what is good or evil, right or wrong, even though they're relative and subject to change, do have certain things in common. And so what is the common basis that all moral beings share, regardless of their moral system? And that is, there is an underlying motive, a reason, a desire. And that's because we are basically thinking beings who not only feel, but those feelings influence and are guided by our reason. And so this all comes under the category of motive. And so whereas the motives may differ and vary subtly in different ways, the reasons we do based on our understanding and knowledge, motive underlies every ethical system, every moral system. Also, there is an object or an aim or an end in view. So we not only have a motive, but we have an aim, an object, an end in view. And because of that, the third underlying basis of all systems is they have a means or a method or a practice or a path, if you will, to get to that aim, to get to that object. So whenever you're looking at your system or any other system of ethics, this is what you want to examine. What is the underlying motive, the reason, the desire? What is the aim in view, and what is the means or practice by which we tend to accompany it? So our talk this morning, that is a higher ethic of spiritual evolution. And so the question is, well, if ethics are good or bad, what does it mean to have a higher or lower ethic? So we would say there's a few reasons we use the term higher. In this sense, we're talking about a set of principles or a basis of thought and action concerning what is good and right for human beings as immortal spiritual souls, divine in essence and potential, evolving spiritually throughout a long series of incarnations in temporary bodies and personalities. So this automatically and from the start raises the motive, the goal, the methods in light of that higher application, not only to what is good for the human being as we find the human being or society, but what is good for that human being as an immortal, essentially divine soul existing over many lives and many personalities, different personalities. The second idea relating to ethical use of or higher ethics of spiritual evolution is the idea of the application of the higher faculties of thought and action and perception of the immortal soul as compared to the exercise of the lower faculties of the body, brain, physical senses, and pure intellect. So we can have ethical systems based on how we should take care of the body, or how we should act in a business group, or in a classroom, or how we should eat, or what we should say. But these all have to do with the faculties of our body, or our brain, or our senses, or our intellect, pure reasoning intellect. And so here we're speaking of a higher ethical system that refers to our higher capacities as soul beings. So we're talking about the application of faculties that have to do more with intuition, compassion, aspiration, the perception of truth, what is enduring and real as opposed to what is temporary. So when we bring in all these higher faculties, our understanding, our motive, our method is raised to a higher level of ethical concern than it would be if we're exercising them in a lower way. And thirdly, we speak of a higher ethical of spiritual evolution because the principles involved are based on universal, self-evident spiritual truths that do not vary across time, place, and condition. And so the difference here is we can have lower, very good ethical systems, but they vary according to the age, the civilization, the group of people and their ability to express and apply those ideas, as opposed to universal, timeless truths that are self-evident, that can be perceived through the exercise of our naturally endowed faculties of reason, of perception, of understanding, of discernment. The higher ethic of spiritual evolution then shares one common object. We spoke about the motivation, we spoke about object, and there is a common object to all higher ethic of spiritual evolution. Because remember, we spoke of spiritual evolution having to do with the evolution of soul over many lives. And so the evolution here, the object is the acquirement of self-conscious realization of the ultimate state of spiritual being, the ultimate state of wisdom, and the ultimate state of bliss. That would be the goal for the higher ethic. And in different cultures, it has different names for this state. It might be called nirvana or godhood or illumination, but it refers to that one goal. The path to that realization becomes twofold, or we might say the methods become twofold, depending on the motivation we have. And as we said, there are two general systems, the doctrine of the I and the doctrine of the heart. And as was mentioned in the previous presentation, the goal is the same. The self-conscious realization of that ultimate state of bliss, knowledge, and being. The goal is the same. The motive difference differs though. The one is called the path of liberation, because the ultimate reason for aiming that is liberation or freedom from ignorance, from misery, suffering, and from delusion. And it's a personal, individual salvation that is sought. And therefore, the method of obtaining it is different. And it can be, so it requires effort. It requires a high ethical standard. And the goal is the same, but the motive varies. And therefore, the results vary as well. So we're now going to focus then more for the remainder of this presentation on the heart doctrine and the path of renunciation. So to begin with, we want to emphasize that it shares with the I doctrine or the path of liberation the same goal, the acquirement of self-conscious union, self-conscious knowledge of the ultimate wisdom, the ultimate bliss, and the ultimate being. The difference, the subtle difference, is the motivation. And this is why it's called the path of renunciation, because the motive or the reason we're doing these things is a renunciation of self-interest or desire for personal reward, and a renunciation of that ultimate state or condition in order to remain in the world to help the spiritual progress of souls who are still under the influence of illusion, ignorance, and suffering. So it is a bliss that is obtained, but it is a bliss which is deferred and renounced for the benefit of those who have not been able to reach that state. So we might say the goal is not individual salvation, but the salvation of all. And as a doctrine, it's not exclusive to any one system of religion, but it can underlie all those systems because it is based on the human nature and not on any external temporary reality of religion or civilization. So the method then also differs because it is not a doctrine of the I. It is not a doctrine of the crowd. It is not one that can be identified and said, oh, this person is a ethical religious person because they practice certain rituals or do certain charities that we can all see and therefore know that they are on a high ethical path. It is sometimes called this path of renunciation, the secret path, because progress is made internally and is very much under the awareness of the individual, but is not apparent to the crowd. It is something that one goes through that is not obvious to others, but is clearly known to oneself. So it is an inner path of an ever-increasing realization of the soul, of the steps necessary to elevate and purify the thought, the feeling, and the perception. This was summarized in the previous talk as as Raj Yoga, which is the discipline and purification of the thought, feeling, and perception of the mind, of the soul. And the necessary steps here are called virtues, not outer practices that we can identify, but inner capacities and powers of the soul that are necessary to overcome the obstacles and elevate the mind and the heart. And once again, the practice of its inner virtues is not obvious to the crowd. It's secret. And yet it is very necessary to this path of renunciation. So even though it cannot be found in books per se, It's not something you can look up in a manual. Like in the Vedas, there are whole sections of the Vedas that have to do with practices, or in the Bible, certain areas of the Old Testament, the New Testament that have to do with certain practices. And yet its stages are given out as signposts, as guidelines, so that one can test, check, and verify, because this is a path that others have taken and have said, you will know that you're on the path, that you're not lost, when you recognize certain things in yourself. And we are clearly given these guidelines. And we're just going to mention them briefly because we still have plenty of time for discussion. One is to act at all times for the benefit of others, primarily as souls like ourselves in evolution. And secondly, while doing that, to renounce any personal self-interest in reward for those actions, even when we know that karmically such actions will not only benefit them, but benefit ourselves as well. So even though we know that right action has a right effect, we do not concern ourselves with that, but primarily with the benefit we can do to others. Thirdly, it is better to act to help others than to refrain from help of others outside because of personal fear. In other words, if you refrain from helping others because you're afraid that you may not know what to do, or whether you're going to harm them, or whether you're going to harm yourself, it is better, out of courage and desire to be of help, to have that motive than to refrain from helping others. In other words, as Krishna says at the end of the Bhagavad Gita, in all cases, act as seemeth best unto thee. And you will learn in time what it is, but you cannot refrain out of fear of action. Perform the duties of life that you find under karma. You do not have to run to any monastery. You do not have to run to any country. You do not even have to look outside your own neighborhood. You will find in the duties that you perform in your everyday life plenty of opportunity to pursue this inner path, because it is a secret, an inner path, and does not require any particular place to worship or to apply it. Perform what is due to others, not just those who seemingly need your help, but those who we might, who may, our family, our friends, and most particularly our enemies. What is due to them as well, those who would oppose to us. And to perform what is due to others without personal regard, or rather being indifferent to whether it is painful or pleasurable for us. There's lots of times we like to do things because they are easy for us. They are pleasurable. We like helping others who acknowledge our help and give us thanks and praise and seem open. But how about the person who how about the tasks that require some effort, that are difficult for us, or might potentially cause some flack? Are we willing to do what is due to others and indifferent to how it may affect us personally? That does not mean we disregard how it may affect them, but our disregard of any way it may affect us personally. And so all this is sort of summarized in our declaration, with the idea is to make ourselves better able or more fit to help and teach others. That's good way of thinking. So at the end of the voice of the silence, when these two paths are laid out, the goal's the same: bliss immediate or bliss deferred. That's the subtle difference. And why would we defer that ultimate bliss? Out of boundless pity and compassion for the world of mortals. And it says the moral choice and of the ethical path is yours. And as a moral thinking being, only you can make it. The only thing a teacher can do is point out the way and the pitfalls, but ultimately, in our everyday lives and over time, the choice and the practice is ours. So we'll start here. We'll stop here and begin to take some questions. We do have a chat that came in, which we can read. The meaning of karma is in the intention. The intention behind action is what matters. Those who are motivated only by desire for the fruits of action are miserable, for they are constantly anxious about the results of what they do. Very true contribution. So are there any other questions or comments? MJW?
Okay. The first speaker read the quote about from Krishna that I established the universe with a portion of myself and remain separate. Now, what is the theosophical view of that? Because it almost sounds like a creator God, and that God, and it could be taken, we don't think that's the intent, but it could be taken as an outside God, something separate from us.
Well, let's consider the words of the Gita in the light of theosophy. There are those who have transformed Krishna, Christ, Buddha into personal outside gods. That's part of free will, reasoning, and choice. Ideation, making something real. Theosophically speaking, if we go back to the Gita and read it as a conversation, a colloquy between the lower man, the ego working through the lower man, the individualized personality endowed with spirit, and the discourse with the higher aspect, that radiation of spirit that's eternal, that radiation of spirit that supersedes all incarnations, then Krishna becomes that voice of the silence, conscience, intuition, wisdom operating in and through, enlightening the lower, Arjuna. So not an external God, but rather the notion of, even found in Christianity, in the book of Matthew, you know, pray within the closet of your heart, pray within, meditate within, to our God who art in heaven. That spiritual font of oneness, the Krishna, the Christ, the Buddha, the enlightened, compassionate one.
So the I doctrine, then, relying on the intellect, reading that scripture, could get the idea of a personal God or a being outside creating the universe. The path of the heart doctrine that relies on intuition, using that higher discernment, can sense that there's another meaning. So Jacob Burma, who was a mystical Christian and taught a Christianity based on the heart doctrine, as rather the I doctrine, proposes this to us. Can we distinguish the difference between the mirror and the reflection in the mirror? Is the mirror the same as the reflection in the mirror? Does the mirror produce the reflection and yet remain separate from it? And if we use our powers of intuition and discernment, we can see that what we call the mirror is a constant. It is the background. It is the necessary basis for that reflection that we see in it. But the reflection, the temporary appearance, is separate from, is something different from the mirror that has produced it. So if we can understand that with our intuitive powers, we can understand the notion, Jacob Burma says, of deity as that absolute presence, that eternal basis of all life, which is the necessity, which is the foundation of existence, and yet stands apart, is not that which projects or is visible to our senses. And so in a sense, that Krishna is speaking from that perspective is the basis, is the source of this universe, and yet remains separate or different from the appearances of that universe. Well, what did we have to do there? In one case, we had to practice the eye doctrine based on our eyes, our physical reasoning, and the other based on our higher heart faculties of feeling and intuition in order to get to that understanding. We have another chat. So, can you read that, JC? Yes.
Sure.
ZZ?
This is from ZZ. In deciding what seems best prior to an action, does an instinct of fear, not for oneself, but the potential effects of the action, help in avoiding? Ooh, good question. Fear. We're working through the fight or flight instincts of the physical, of the animal form of man, aren't we? We know about the adrenaline rush and that process that's definitely real and physical. Fight, flight, or freeze. We get that. We've experienced that. But as we're considering in the moment, as soul, using this physical frame, it is possible for the body to be shaky with fear. I'm going to avoid this. I'm going to flee. I'm going to freeze. I'm not doing this. It's possible for the body to be reacting that way, but soul operating within through mind and ideation can then go through a transformative process, self-reflection, self-consciousness, where we're thinking, wait a second, is this fear that I'm observing in the physical, is that about maintaining the personal existence and safety? Or is that fear based on a compassionate urge to protect the other? And there begins action in thought and motive and the transmutation of the mundane into the spiritual realm. If we are considering the needs of another, we find ourselves concerned for them, then we make the effort on this plane to sense what the other is actually asking or needing, to figure out a method of empowering them, enforcing them to make changes and choices that are needed. And then we just step back and let go.
Once again, answering this question depends whether we're going to approach it from the doctrine of the eye or the doctrine of the heart. So we find Arjuna in the first chapter at the very point described by this question. Here we have the bravest, the most accomplished and well-known warrior in the world, adept in the use of all weapons, frozen out of fear for doing harm to others. Fear of hurting others, those he loves, even though they would destroy him. And yet, Krishna says to him, your sentiments are those who are bound to the doctrine of the eye. In other words, the literal interpretation of the scriptures. And he tries to get him up and teach him, you know, you can't destroy what is indestructible in the human being. You have to understand that. And later in another book, The Voice of the Silence, which is explaining the heart doctrine to us, it says, he who would fail to plunge out of terror of the stream, out of fear that they might do harm to self, or they might act for self, for selfish interest. In that case, we have an action based on fear, which becomes an action in a deadly sin. In other words, we can do harm, but by what we fear not to do, even though we may think it's right, as to by doing the wrong thing. And so constantly throughout there in the devotional books, we see that we are here as souls to learn. And that learning is one through experience. And anybody who's successful at anything is not afraid of failure. Because failure does not mean we're bad. Failure means we're willing to dare to try new things, come out of our comfort zone, that we're familiar with. And therefore, we learn from our failures and learn to do better. Become our stepping stones. Go ahead, JC.
Oh, we have another chat, and it's an interesting chat. This is from DAE, and it actually reflects how these teachings come down into the head doctrine, the crowd, the I doctrine, the crowd, and the beginning of a spiritual enlightenment. DAE writes, in popular culture, in the early Star Wars films, the phrase, may the force be with you, is oft stated, and was an intentional insertion of showing that force which pervades the universe, pervading everywhere, but down to the smallest atom in each person. All that flows from that power, so difficult for the mind to take in, is composed of love and vibration. And so there's another reminder that popular culture has so many different ways of communicating at a variety of levels simultaneously, so that experience and insights can be gained by those who are striving to know and testing out, practicing to understand motive and action.
If we go back to those Star Wars films, may the Force be with you, we remember that the Force was also very strong in Darth Vader.
Yes.
In other words, the force of good and the force of evil is one in essence. What matters is how it's applied. Our motive, our knowledge, our method, our goal. So that force can only be with us for good if that is our intention and that is our understanding. Because the same force or power of spirit is also behind all our wrong actions. We are spiritual beings. We are one in essence with that power. And it is always with us in potentially, but we actively use it as will according to our desire and our understanding. And one more chat, before we act, as has been suggested, we should make sure we are not acting from fear, but are acting from unity. So once again, if we are going to be cautious, if we are going to be careful, if we're going to be patient with acting, it's not out of fear, but out of consideration, out of study. Is what I am doing in service of unity? Is it an expression of, and will it have the results to contributing to that unity, or it will disrupt it? So The basis for acting or not acting is not out of personal fear, but based out of knowledge of acting for the results. So it said, angels fear to tread where fools rush in. So motive enough, fearlessness enough alone, excuse me, motive and fearlessness alone are not enough. We need knowledge as well. And here we have this great opportunity to study and discuss together so we can become higher moral and ethical beings. And so at this point, we did want to mention that we will continue throughout the month of February looking at this process, because we live in a world where there is diversity. But if we are to act ethically, we have to find the unity among all that diversity. And that is a mystery to us, a challenge to us, not only in discovering it, but learning how to apply it in our everyday lives. And so next week, we'll look at the basis for unity and the cause of diversity. And this, of course, we are going on into this Wednesday on heredity, memory and reincarnation, where that applies. So we welcome your continued participation, and thank you all for attending today.
Thanks, everybody. See you next week.